to order the meeting. Finance Committee. The Vice Chair has finally arrived.
I apologize. I try hard to be here.
Yes, you do. You do. It was shocking when you weren't here.
I'll move approval in minutes.
I don't think we have any public here to comment, so the minutes are approved. We have no unfinished business. Eva, 5.1.
Well, 5.1 is the...
We all do a kind of a conga line dance around the room or something with this one.
As you know, that we do this every 2 years. We do an actuarial evaluation. We contracted with Milliman. John Botsford is here. You've met him plenty of times. He's here to kind of go over the report in detail and to answer any questions that you may have. Take it away, John.
All right, thank you. Does everyone have a copy of our evaluation report that we prepared? Mm-hmm. May 21st.
Mine doesn't have the fancy binding.
None of ours.
Our office manager did this for me this morning.
Yeah,
gave me
good.
A little bound copy.
They still have one. They still have one of those machines that you can do it with.
Yeah, so I can flip through. As mentioned, or as you know, the good news is that you're 100% funded now. I think the funding started back in 2006.
Yes.
We originally started that plan, and it, you know, initially when I came to report, it was, you know, 10% funded, 20% funded.
Yep.
A long way to go.
Yep.
50, 75, and now you're at 100.
Yeah, here we are 12 years later.
And you're at 100%.
Yes.
And I think your funding strategy was actually to get it done more like over 20 or so years.
Yep.
So it got done faster than expected.
I want to give credit there to Greg Rogers and Jim Livingstone. Because Jim and I were on the finance committee at that time. And it was Greg and Ava that recommended we go down this path and fund this thing. And honestly, that's not something Jim and I would have thought up on our own. But I'm just thrilled that we're here.
That's right. So that's the good news. 100% funding does not mean you never have to put another dime in the, mm-hmm. in the plan, though. It does mean that the liabilities as accrued to date are fully funded, but you'll have new employees that are hired in the future, and they're going to accrue liabilities. And the way we measure that 100% funding, for retirees, it's, you know, they're fully funded. And for actives, it's designed that you fund active liabilities throughout their working careers. So if you have an active employee who's, say, halfway through their career, you're 100% funded, meaning you funded half of their benefits. And
okay.
then in piecewise, you would continue to fund small amounts each year for them until they retire, so that you kind of maintain that 100% funded status. So
would you recommend a new hire that we give them a carton of camels to work on?
We can change that mortality assumption, right?
Right.
Correct.
So,
a special
flavor.
Load, the camel load.
So, you know, Dan Bornstein likes to use a credit card analogy in that. And this is a case where we have paid our balance.
That's right.
That doesn't mean that there won't be future charges to that card, but we have paid our balance.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so if we go to, you know, page 2, and I'll just kind of take you through a few highlights. First off, this is the valuation and the, you know, the calculations of the liabilities is pretty much the same as it was before, but the accounting standard has kind of overlaid the valuation. Has changed a little bit, and so you can see some little bit different terminology from GASB 45 to GASB 75 in terms of you know, so the main key, if you go to page 2 of the results, what we call total OPEB liability, that used to be called the actuarial accrued liability under the old standard, and now it's called total OPEB liability, and that's your $27.8 million. The fiduciary net position, why they came up with that term, I don't know, but really that just means the market value of assets, okay? So it's pretty simple in terms of what that is. So market value of assets, $28.2 million.
Meaning and at this point in time,
as of that date,
as of 2017.
Wow. Which is last year.
Yeah, valuation date was done June 30, 17. So it's done every 2 years. So as of that date, there was a $400,000 surplus, or meaning you're 101% funded.
So if you had if you had this 28...
245.
245 in cash, with the 28245 in a T-bill, it would consider it the same amount of money.
Yeah, it's the market value of assets, so 28.2 million. So you're saying if it was in, I mean...
That's kind of a, I understand why they do it, but it assumes that you'll never make any money off your investments. Just kind of an odd position to...
Not necessarily. So the assets that you hold right now is 28.2 million.
Right.
So that's what's sitting in your fund. You know, you could turn it into cash tomorrow, or you could leave it in the investments and you're...
Well, I'm not saying that we should. It's
right. On the liability side, is the 27.8 million, that's where there's, I guess you can say there is an implicit assumption that there's going to be investment returns on assets in order to cover
okay.
them.
Okay.
Because really the liabilities, what that means, that 27.8 million, that's essentially present value of future benefit payments. Mm-hmm. So the future benefit payments are what they are. You know, you have whatever, it's a million next year and a million 2 years, whatever it is, and it goes on for 50 years, these payments, we have to discount those payments back to today. If we assume
zero, you use 6.5% for that right. discount rate.
If we use 0%, it would probably be double.
Right.
But we use 6.5%, meaning we assume 6.5% return long term.
Okay.
That's what gets us to the 27.8
Got it.
Million.
All right. Thank you.
Question, between pages 2 and 5.
Right.
At the top of page 2, it says valuation date as of June 30th, 2017, and it lists the liability and the net position.
Right.
You turn to page 5.
Right.
It says for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2018.
Right.
It cites the same numbers.
That's
so
right.
So valuation date of June 30th, 2017 for the fiscal year ending 2018, but it's the same numbers. I'm missing something.
Yeah. It's how, it's by design in terms of how the accounting mechanism works. So this is your liability as of June 30, 2017.
That's what you put on the books for.
For June 30th.
Right, and it's exactly the way the pension liabilities work. There's a 1 year lag. And so you have a valuation date of June 30, 2017. Your fiscal year end is June 30, 2018. But under the GASB accounting standard, you're allowed to use when you report your liabilities for fiscal year ending June 30, 2018, you're allowed to use 1 year prior of the June 30, 2017, which is what you've done on the, okay. which what we've done here and what you do on the pension side. The pension side, CalPERS does it because they typically don't have their valuation reports done for over a year after the valuation date. We've kind of done the same, one, to be analogous to that, and two, so that you can get your numbers in advance of the fiscal year end, essentially,
sure.
right.
which is everybody wants, so you've got that kind of predictability and you're not scrambling okay. at the last minute.
Having that, what is the net position today?
Yeah, so I don't have...
Well, we have it as part of, you're talking about what are
our assets. The assets
it's in one of our, it's in the packet.
Yeah,
we're
so
gonna go over that.
You would know the asset value as of probably 3/31/2018.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely higher than what it was here.
Yes.
But it might be lower today than it was March 31st.
It could be. I mean, it's...
Which is part of the point of just kind of pegging a date.
Oh, okay, here we go. 5.4, that's right.
Yeah. And so what was the total number of the assets?
It is.
So it's even higher. So 28.2 to 29.6. So, because there were investment returns on assets.
29.7.
Yeah, and it was, you had very good returns the last 6 months of the year through December. And in fact, even January was a big month. And then it kind of went haywire in February. They gave it all back.
Yeah,
and
it was sort February
of was a roller coaster. But year to date, 9 months through 331, I think you're sort of still positive.
29.7.
So now what's going to happen is at the same time, even though that those assets are going to go up, your liabilities over time do go up. And that's because you've got, remember how I mentioned it's the present value of future benefits. So And I always like to use a simple example of you owe $1,000 10 years from now. You discount that back, and let's just say 7%, make it easy, to today's dollars, and that's worth $500. So then we step forward 2 years. And so now that same $1,000 payment hasn't changed at all, mm-hmm. is now due 8 years from now. The present value of that is now 570, not 500. And so as you get closer to making those payments, you're naturally going to have that present value go up. It's the same thing with this, except you've got a stream of future payments. So all those future payments, right. you step 2 years closer from one valuation date to the next, that's going to go up a little bit. So that's one thing that drives it up. The second thing that drives it up, as I mentioned, how we allocate those costs for the active employees throughout their working career. They're halfway through the career, and that's when we funded the date. So then we fund a piecemeal in what's called a normal cost or service cost, as it's the definition now, as opposed to normal cost. And that's the value of benefits assigned to 1 year service, so that's going to bring it up as well. There's also going to be a downward, so even though that's bringing it up, it will go down as well to the extent that stream of future payments, the payments within the next year or since the last valuation date, so the valuation date back in June 30, 2015 to 17, there's 2 years of benefit payments that were factored into the June 30, 2015 present value that you no longer owe in 2017. So that'll actually reduce the liability. But the net effect is with the service cost and the interest rate, the net effect is generally you're going to see an increase in the liability, but at the same time, an increase in assets due to, one, investment returns that you're earning on the assets, and two, any contributions that you make. So in a perfect world, the contributions that you would be making to those assets would simply be the what we call the service cost. And then the benefit payments that would come out of the assets would, so rather than you funding the benefit payments on a pay-as-you-go basis, like you were doing a pay-as-you-go plus an amount into the fund, the pay-as-you-go payments, now you simply reimburse yourself from the fund. And you say, I'm going to put in the service cost each year, but my benefit payments that I was making on pay-as-you-go, that I'm just going to have the fund pay for that now. Right. Just as you do on the pension fund, those benefit payments for pensioners, those are being paid out of the pension fund and not out of operating assets that you have. And so that's kind of where you are now, that's where you want to be.
One of the other downward trends is that we have a different benefits package
right.
for new employees than we did for employees 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so as older employees retire and newer employees are hired in, the liability associated with the newer employees is less than the liability associated with the employees that retired.
Right. And so over time you will see, that will start to pull it down because, mm-hmm. We're going to project it's going to kind of go
sure.
up. But then it's going to reach kind of a peak and then mm-hmm. start to come down. It's going to take a while because
sure.
I think that change happened maybe 2014 or 13.
Well, we had two changes, didn't we? Or three.
Did
we have three tiers or four tiers?
Probably 12 or 13.
Yeah.
That's when PEPRA was moving
right.
in. So it was
right.
Right.
The year
PEPRA.
Prior to PEPRA, I think, mm-hmm. went to the healthcare savings accounts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So July 1st, 2014. So
do we have two tiers or three tiers on the retiree benefits, though? I thought we had three tiers.
We have three.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the big one is when they go after 2000, the hires after 2014,
right.
you're just paying $133 a month. Whereas the ones before that, there was a vesting schedule. Yeah, there was
right.
a before 2006 hires had, but they, you were essentially paying a pretty large amount of money going to them. So yes, as you have new employees coming in, that service cost I mentioned, that's going to go down as you have current employees under the old tiers retiring and new employees coming in under the new tier, their normal cost is going to be a lot less. So over time, it's going to shift and that annual cost is going to go down. But
didn't you say it's going to take about 10 or 15 years?
Yeah, I was going to guess it was like a 20-year process.
It's probably, yeah. I mean,
okay.
if we were to run it out, that's probably what it would look like, because you'd see it going up initially and then it'd start coming down.
And we did say we wanted to have him kind of do an analysis to see what that would look like.
Okay.
Um,
So with just a couple of other things, page six, you know, that's exhibit two. We already talked about page five, exhibit one, and then kind of the 1 year lag that we talked about. Let's finish up with page five, because we talked about the liabilities and the measurement date. There's also a term, actuarially determined contribution. And so that's really equal to what I mentioned, the service cost, which I defined before, the value benefits accruing during the year, plus an amortization of your any unfunded liability. So you have no unfunded liability. So the actuarially determined contribution, that's that $1.343 million there. That would be kind of a target contribution that you make in order to kind of maintain that fully funded status. But again, that's the total contribution. That's not, you wouldn't make that and make all the pay-as-you-go payments that are as well. You would, it's just, that's the total amount. Your pay-as-you-go payments, I believe, were running at about $1 million a year or so.
105.1?
Yeah. Is that the benefit payments,
John? Yeah, so benefit payments were about $1 million a year. So, so really the, you know, you're, at some point, your benefit payments are going to be greater than that actuarially determined contribution. That happens as you have funds that mature, and they have more and more retirees. And what that means is that the fund would have what's called negative cash flow. Okay, so the contributions you're putting into the fund are less than the benefit payments coming out of the fund. And negative cash flow is not necessarily a bad thing, as long as you're well-funded and you're situated. Negative cash flow is a bad thing when you're poorly funded and you're projected to continue to, you know. But when you're well-funded and you're getting those investment returns on assets and everything's kind of in balance, you will have a situation where you may have negative cash flows and yet the plan can be perfectly healthy.
Okay.
Even CalPERS, as large as they are, they actually do have negative cash flows, even though they're, you know, now they're trying to up their contributions for other reasons because they are, you know, they do have a funded gap that they need to fill.
Right.
So they're trying to move themselves where they, instead of having that kind of a large negative cash flow going on, they're boosting up the contributions probably to make them about equal for a while and let those investment returns try and put themselves back into a fully funded situation.
Could I ask you about this note on page 7, John? Note 1, benefit payments shown is equal to the annual pay-as-you-go cost of the $825,000 plus $226,000 to reflect the implicit subsidy benefits reported in Note 12.
Mm-hmm.
So those implicit subsidies are what?
Yeah, right. So the benefits that you have, you know, for healthcare benefits are... CalPERS charges the same premium to the city, whether it's a 25-year-old or a 63-year-old. So it's the same, you know, whatever it is. So let's call it $800 a month. And, but in reality, the 25-year-old is going to, their claims costs or expected claims costs or the economic value of that health benefit is going to be a lot lower than $800 a month. And the 63-year-old is going to be a lot higher than $800 a month because older people tend to have higher health, you know, the health issues and so on and so forth. So what the GASB accounting standard tells us that we must do is that we have to show the liability, we have to value the economic value of that benefit as opposed to just say, well, that's the premium. And so the premium is, you know, since you're charging the same premium, average premium for everyone, then there's no liability. I mean, an extreme example is if you charge the same premium, or the CalPERS charges the same premium to everybody, and you charge the retiree the full premium amount. You say, well, it's $800. So then you say, well, we have no liability because they are paying the $800. Well, in reality, if you were to have CalPERS split what they charge, and you say, set the retiree premiums just for those retirees and tell us what that's going to cost, and then do the same for the active, they'd say, well, your retirees are you know, $1,200 or $1,300 a month, and the actives are only $500 a month. And so there'd be the split. And so we're required to value what's called the implicit rate subsidy, the difference between what the premium, average premium is charged and the economic value of that. And so that's what that implicit subsidy is, and that's baked into your 25.9 or $27.8 million in liabilities. There's a subsidy that's baked in there. What that means is that when we reconcile from one year to the next, is, and you say, what's our benefit payment? If you don't want to account for that subsidy, you're basically going to be drawing down the liabilities, because remember how I said you have, as that benefit payment is no longer owed, well, you no longer owe that implicit subsidy on those last couple of years too, since the last valuation date, and that's representing that $226,000, and so we've got to reduce our liabilities to reflect the fact that you no longer owe that money. And so what you're essentially doing is that you're saying, okay, I'm going to count my liabilities for my retirees with this added subsidy, and I am, but at the same time, my active, you know, you're saying, what's my active cost? And it's $800 a month for that same active. In reality, it's not $800, it's $500. And so rather than saying, well, I'm going to say my cost is $800 a month, you know, for my actives and $800 a month for this retiree, you say the cost for the retiree is $1,100 and the cost for the active is $500, right? So there's a, essentially what you're doing is you're taking a portion of that implicit rate subsidy and you would apply that to the, against that active cost.
Is,
and that would end up, you know, kind of lowering your...
Is that an indication you have an older workforce that, that this implicit
subsidy... It's an indication
subsidy?
That retirees are... it's an indication that retirees are older than your active workforce.
I would hope so.
Yeah, what would happen is if you have a young workforce, you're going to have a much higher implicit subsidy. If you have an older workforce that's almost the same age as the retirees, the subsidy would be almost non-existent.
Oh, okay, so it's the opposite of what I was thinking. All right.
Yeah. So that's all that is. But yeah, the good news is, you know, you're essentially getting... You should be essentially in your accounting to make sure that all the accounting works. Is that $226,000 ends up being a credit against your right? Because your real dollar cost is $825, right?
Right.
So you owe that $825. You pull $825 out of the fund to pay for that, but then you pull another $226 out of the fund, and you apply it toward your against your active. So you're essentially lowering, you know, your active premiums is how you would, you know, the I'm trying to explain what all the journal entries are. I'll let the accountants figure that out. But that's essentially what's happening.
Okay.
Okay. Just jumping back real quick to page 6. This is just, you're required to disclose this, and this is when I said, well, you know, there's some changes under GASB and what you have to do. Required to show the sensitivity of changes in discount rate assumptions, as well as health cost trend, and what that would do to your liability. So you can see we're assuming 6.5%, and that's a $400,000 surplus. If the discount rate were increased to 7.5%, you would see that surplus balloon up to $3 million. On the other hand, if the discount rate was only 5.5% and it dropped by 1%, you would go from a $400,000 surplus down to a $2.6 million unfunded liability. So it's just to give the reader of financial statements an idea of how sensitive a change in discount rate would be to what you're showing as your funded status.
Okay.
And then it's required to do the same thing with a plus or minus 1% change to health cost trend rate. Because remember, we assume... We don't just say, well, whatever the premiums are today is what they're going to stay. We build in an escalation rate to those premiums each and every year. And so this gives you an idea that if those escalation rates went up or down 1%, then you would see that you would roughly have either, you know, it would either go from a $3.6 million surplus to a $3.4 million unfunded liability. So that's all that is. Exhibit 4, and again, this just more gets into kind of the accounting in terms of how it works. it's for the, you know, we tried to label it, even though it's a 6/30/2017 valuation, this is what your annual expense would be for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2018. And you can see the components of service costs and interest costs. And again, this is mandated by GASB 75 and how this is laid out. And it's analogous to GASB 68 on your pension side. So you would see the very similar thing that PERS prepares for you on GASB 68. So it's going to look the same in terms of the components. But at the end, you know, kind of the bottom line number of your expense would be that 1.22, call it 1.225 million.
John, are we required, just like we do with CalPERS, to include on the pension side on this? We have to include all these schedules within the CAPR. Mm-hmm. But before, we only had a few lines.
Right.
Now we have going to be pages.
That's probably. Right. Okay. That's right. And you'll have to include the sensitivity that we went the plus and minus 1%. That's going to be one of the footnotes. Mm-hmm. Say, here's the sensitivity. And then you have this, which is, you know, that this is an actual, you know, the 1.225 should actually go into your, you know, your expense, your P&L, right? But then you've got what's called deferred inflows and outflows of resources. And what that does is if you flip to page 9, so these are just schedules of, and again, I don't know why they had to use the term deferred inflows and outflows of resources. It's pretty complicated, but and it's not really descriptive, but essentially what it's saying is that you have investment gains and losses, as well as potentially gains and losses due to assumption changes or demographic gains and losses. But the investment gains and losses, to the extent that you have a gain or a loss, or to the extent that your actual investment returns are higher or lower than 6.5%, you would have a gain or a loss, and that gets recognized over a 5-year period. And so that's all this is doing, just recognizing gains or losses over 5 years.
So it's taking the 184 and dividing it by 5.
That's right, 184. So then you recognize the 36.
All right.
You recognize 36,000, and then the other 147,000 is deferred, and it shows as a deferred inflow over the next 5 years. And what will happen is you'll start to see layers of that in the future where you're going to have, you know, investment. This in Exhibit 5, you're going to start seeing date established. So you just have 6/30/18, you'll have 6/30/19, 6/30/20, 6/30/20. So you'll eventually get up to 5 years, and you'll have 5 years of these things before they're complete. And then it'll say, you know, original recognition period, years remaining, you know, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then it'll kind of sum it all up. And then same thing with the economic demographic gains or losses. You're going to have a gain or a loss from, you know, 1 year to the next, to the extent the demographics are different. And that gets amortized over, see the 8.57, that's the average expected future service for all of your participants. And so it gets amortized over. In the past, remember, GASB 45 says, okay, you have an unfunded liability, so then we have what was called the ARC, or annual required contribution, which is really your, you know, your expense. And they said, oh, you can amortize that unfunded liability over 30 years when we first started this, and say, well, that's what goes into your expense. And they're saying, no, you're not going to be able to amortize this over 30 years, at least for accounting purposes. You need to amortize investment gains and losses in 5 years, and your average expected future service for anything else. And in fact, plan changes would get amortized immediately. So if there was like a benefit improvement, they say you need to recognize that immediately. Any other questions? I mean, other than, you know, it's good news, but are there any other questions in terms of the, you know, the valuation results themselves, the funded status, and what you might expect in the future, or just GASB 75 and that transition that I can answer?
These folks end up, somebody 68 years old, retired from the city. They are getting, they're getting Medicare benefits, and then this is the this is the additional amounts that would have like been their Part B payment in other instances, or their optical benefits and those sorts of things. What are we actually paying for?
Yeah, so it depends on, well, first it depends on what tier they're in, and then it depends on...
Let's say it's the folks that started before 2014.
Yeah, so, and then it depends on when, because up until age 65, they get one benefit, and then after age 65, it changes.
Right, okay.
And so if they retire before 65, they get, hang on just a second.
We're covering their entire health premium.
Right.
Right.
Plus the optical and dental.
That's right. It pays for the entire cost of health, dental, and vision benefits for retirees and their spouses until age 65, subject to the vesting schedule. So it's 100% if they're 12 years. After age 65, what you do is you basically say, we'll still cover your costs, but we're going to cap it. And that cap gets indexed by 2% per year. And that amount is up to $426. So the maximum they're going to get, or that you're going to owe for the people over 65, is $426 a month. But they can get there pretty quickly if they're enrolled in CalPERS, because the premiums for CalPERS, the cheapest premium for somebody over age 65 is like $300 a month. You add in dental, vision, and if there's a Medicare part you know, B, you're going to get to 426 pretty quickly. But that escalates at 2% per year. And so that's the group that, you know, pre-2014, the ones hired after 2014, all they get is 100, and that gets indexed as well, but it's currently $133 a month. It doesn't matter what their premium is, they get $133 a month toward their CalPERS medical premium, and that's it. And if they don't enroll in CalPERS, they get nothing.
What if they just decide, I'm going to be a Medicare enrollee?
Right.
They're fine, right? I mean, with that $130. This is the piece I don't get. Like, I don't understand why, fundamentally, I don't understand why municipalities decide to do this. I mean, Medicare has existed since the late 60s.
Right.
And the one government benefit that people like more than any other.
Right.
And they've paid into Medicare, or they haven't? Have these folks paid into Medicare?
I believe most of these have. There are some government agencies where people have not paid into Medicare.
Okay.
But I believe your group, everybody's paid in.
Yeah, we're...
So they become then a Medicare
eligible. So they're Medicare eligible. Right. So, you know, CalPERS says, you know, well, you have Medicare, right? And that's Part B premium, so that's $120 a month or whatever it's up to.
Right.
But if you have higher income, it can be as much as $300 or $400 a month. So that's Part B.
Okay.
Part A is for major hospital. Part B is that you go to the doctor. Part A is for hospital. And then there's prescription drugs, which is covered under either A and B. And up until, you know, 12 years ago, prescription drugs, everybody was kind of on, you know, Medicare didn't cover any of it. Now they do, but there's another cost for the drugs. And so if you have somebody that just says, I'm just going to be on Medicare, right, and Medicare, like your major hospital, there's a deductible, and it's something like, I can't remember what it's up to, but it's something like $900. So you go to the hospital, and there's like a $900 deductible. Then there's some copay and co-insurance. Now there's some maximums that hit. Same thing with the physician. There's deductibles, and so there's a lot of out-of-pocket costs those who were just in Medicare are faced with. And then, of course, there's the prescription drugs, trying to get that covered, and those can be very expensive.
Okay.
So then you say, I want to create a policy. You can do Medigap, which is under the individual market where I'm going to buy, or you can go a Medicare Advantage through like Kaiser. And so you pay an additional premium, and they fill in the gaps. They fill in so you don't have a $900 deductible. You don't have these high copays or co-insurance. You don't have... you know, kind of stripped down benefits that you might get under Medicare, you get, and there's other things that Medicare says, well, we're only going to pay up to this amount, and then there's nothing after that,
right,
when you talk about some of the durable medical equipment, so on and so forth, and that's why people say, I'm on Medicare, but I've got these big costs, so that's where this insurance comes in. you know, and it's a fair question to say, well, CalPERS is pretty expensive for Medicare sub policies at $300-something a month. It does cover prescription drugs, which is a pretty good chunk of it. But even so, you know, their premiums are fairly expensive compared to
a Medicare Advantage,
Medicare Advantage policy that you might just buy. The reason is those individual Medicare Advantage policies, there's two things they tend to do. They tend to have slightly higher deductibles than the CalPERS, which is a lot lower. The out-of-pocket maximums are higher, and they may have skinnier networks in terms of doctors. You know, there's Medicare, but then they might even make the network.
But if they're choosing Kaiser.
They're choosing Kaiser, it's Kaiser, so it is what it is. But if they're choosing, you know, Blue Shield or whatever, they might have a very skinny network. And so it is something to watch and say, at what point does the cost gets so high that it's better to say, you know, we're not going to offer anything, and we're just going to say, go get your individual Medicare policy on the market because the most expensive
one is like $170
a month, right?
To buy it
and go get it, and we'll pay you up to a couple hundred bucks, which is how you used to do it. But then when you went into CalPERS for your active employees, the deal was is that you had to at least offer benefits for retirees. That's just part of the package of CalPERS.
Oh,
there's a lot of reasons why you went into CalPERS. And, you know, there were some issues there that you had to solve the problems on the active side, which you did, but it did, and that's why the retirees, you kind of restructured and said, we're only going to give you the minimum. And we factor that in. We assume that because they're only getting $133 a month, you're going to have a number of retirees that say, because they're going to have to pay the other $270, $300, you're going to have some of them that say, I can go get a Medicare Advantage policy for $80 a month, depending on where they live,
right?
$80 or $90 a month, which gives me all the coverage I need. I don't need to spend $200 a month for CalPERS. And so you'll have that. You'll have a number of them say, thanks, but no thanks, I decline. And then your out-of-pocket cost is nothing.
If they decline, do they decline forever?
Yeah.
Once they're out, they're out?
Yeah, so they got like 120 days or something, and they're to enroll, and they enroll, and once they drop, you know, that's it.
Okay.
And CalPERS doesn't want to be selected again, so they've got certain rules where they don't want people coming and going.
Sure.
Just because otherwise they're going to get all the unhealthy people when they need it, so.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Other questions on?
Any other questions?
I don't.
That's all I have.
Move to accept the report. Is that
okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Very good news. Celebrate. Sound happier next time, John.
Yeah.
Actuaries aren't used to delivering good news, right?
There can't be many cities that are in the 100% funded.
No, there's not. There's not. Yeah, yeah. So I, but yeah, you're in very good shape. But I may not sound excited. I'm wiped out because I had my two oldest daughters graduate from high school on Friday.
Really?
Oh, another daughter in eighth grade on Thursday. So we've been doing nothing but that, and then we had our big party. And I'm just like.
Have you actuarially determined how much their college education is going to cost?
I've got that coming.
Yeah. Where do they go to high school?
In Moraga, so Campo Linda High School is where they went.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to go, my two oldest are actually going to go to the same college. They're going to go to the University of Portland.
My daughters go to Portland.
Yeah. University of Portland, okay, yeah. Really?
Yes.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
one's a nurse and one's between her junior and senior year. Yeah.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, they're pretty excited to go.
By good rain.
Yeah, if you want, I can get them some contact info.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good.
I can show them where the party's at.
Yeah. I'm
Big Dad.
Big Dad, real happy with that one.
Yeah, sure, we're not known for being a party school, but if you really want to find a party in college, you can find one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's great.
It wasn't
news.
That bad, Jeff. You don't have
it's
to leave.
Funny. Yeah, they've really enjoyed it. It's good.
Yeah, they're looking forward to it. So I'm hoping at least one of them goes into nursing because they have such a great program up there. But right
they
now
do.
they're not, but they're going to explore their freshman year. They can check it out. So
Yeah.
We'll see. All right.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. Small world.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry, lost my agenda there. Item two, Eva. Draft revisions to the contract and procurement ordinance.
Okay, the last.
So kind of basically, maybe I can just sum this up. You've raised the rate that raised the number.
Right, because it was a it was mentioned that the city manager should look at possibly increasing the purchasing authorization limits. So what we did is we, as a staff, looked at other cities' policies, and there was no one that matched or had any rhyme or reason why they had their policy in place. So I just assumed that it's based on their comfort levels. So between the city manager, city attorney, and the department heads, we kind of got together and kind of did an analysis as to what would fit the city and that it would create more of an effective workflow. So these are the changes that staff has proposed, and we wanted to just have some discussion with the finance committee.
Yeah, I went through it. I don't have a problem with this.
Me neither.
Now, does that mean that future contracts at $89,000 will not be, we won't see them here?
You won't see them until they go over the $100,000.
So if they get amended over the $100,000, you would see them.
Yes, you would see them.
But an $89,000 contract, you won't see it.
And that's the life of the agreement.
Critical. And any real sensitive, critical ones that we would bring forward, if the city manager feels the same. So the next steps to this is to bring it to the council.
Good.
And what we also want to do is just make sure all the ordinances, anything attached, that we make sure that we look at all of them, make sure that we didn't leave anything out.
Okay. 5.3, proposed 2018-19 statement of investment policy. Candace, you finally get to talk.
Good afternoon. So this is an annual update of the statement of investment policy, and FTN Financial has recommended a few changes, and there's a few changes from the finance staff as well. So on page one, which is page 55 of your packet, we added this section that says scope, and this was recommended by GFOA. Just to clarify which specific funds are available for investment and which funds are excluded.
Okay.
On page 61 of the title, under diversification by investment type and issuer, we added the word sector, so it says sector and issuer limits. And then this table was put there just for clarification, so everything looks neater and easier to read. And on page 62, under brokers and dealers, we removed the wording that said purchases of original issues of treasury and federal securities. I won't read the whole thing, but removed all of that and replaced it to say that CDs, because CDs and commercial paper and corporate bonds can also be purchased as original issues. So we needed that clarification. And also we added a little more verbiage about purchases and securities, and saying that new issues do not require three authors. And then on pages 64 to 68.
Glossary.
Right, we added a glossary based upon GFOA recommendations.
I would add one other thing to this. Is my thought, I mean, this is what I was always taught. Under diversification, dividing investment among a variety of securities offering independent returns with the objective of lowering risk, and you're actually, while increasing your returns, that's actually what happens.
So that's on page?
That's on page 65. So you're going to lower your risk and you're going to increase your returns. That's why you do it. There's an added value to it of doing that. One question I had about this is the rebalancing. Do we talk about rebalancing at all? Like, say we have, if you have something where you're saying, I'm going to be at one third in A, one third in B, and one third in C. A does great, you peel returns out of A and reallocate to B and C to keep yourself balanced the same way, so you don't get overloaded in A. Do we have anything like that?
We have a policy that we only can have so much in
certain percentage
in certain sectors.
That's what that table is all about. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, and that's why we want to make it a little clearer.
So I guess we would move
if we got above something. Okay.
Right.
All right,
so
that's fine.
But the de facto rebalance.
Yeah.
Well, particularly in the single issuer, if you get a single issuer that's grown from you're just under 2% and they do great, now you're over 2.5%.
It forces you to get out of some of these. Right. Okay. And you reference supranational organizations. Right.
Yes, yeah, so we don't
World
have
Bank.
To explain that
right.
Cool. Scott, any questions? I'm fine with it as well.
Here's more good news.
California Employers Retirement Benefits.
29.7.
Candace.
So this is the March 31st statement for the CERT Trust. So we ended at $29.7 million. As you can see, we took a big hit for
$400,000.
Unfortunately. But overall, for the fiscal year, we still had $1.5 million in investment earnings. So we did still have good earnings. And that's the balance at the end of March. And so in May, we requested reimbursement for some of the retiree health payments, which totaled $574,000. So that will be deducted. You'll see that in the next quarter.
So just to help me along with this, the connection of this to what John was talking about.
Yes, that's as of March 31st, where his evaluation was as of June of last year.
Okay.
So this is 9 more months.
Yeah.
So more than...
So for 9 more months, we're up $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We might have been up $1.9 million.
Right, or more, if we had gone the other way.
Somebody hadn't talked about tariffs, right?
Right!
But that's just on interest on earnings only. We didn't make any contributions.
No contributions, that was just earnings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's good news.
Yeah.
Any questions, Scott? Should we just accept the report?
Accept the report and pass it on to the council.
All right.
Now, like you said, the liability went up, so you can't just take this and divide it by the previous liability, mm-hmm. but still, the liability certainly didn't go up by more than $1.4 million. So we're in even better shape than we were before.
Yes.
Whether it's 1.2 or 1.10, we're in better shape. Okay.
5.5, draft investment guidelines for the Section 115 Pension Trust.
So this is the pension trust that we just created and opened with PARS. The council approved that back in November 2017, and we made our initial $100,000 deposit. Back in February, we presented to the council to retreat how we would continue to fund this this pension trust. And one of the ideas that we had is that we would then, first of all, we can fund it because we don't have that arc that we have to make with the OPEB trust, that $1.6 million. So we can now use that to deposit into the PARS trust. And then the next thing is now that we're getting reimbursed for the retiree payments, we can take some of that. We didn't want to take all of it. We wanted to keep some in the bank. We wanted to take at least $400,000 of that for a total of $2 million to kind of put in the trust. And this is what we would use for to kind of offset some of the pension rate.
Right.
CalPERS.
Now, in theory, we could actually send this money to PERS.
We could.
But remind me again what the benefit is of sending it to PARS instead of PERS. Because that's an option we have.
That's an option.
Right.
You tend to have better control because then you can kind of set up your own strategy or the pension trust has their strategy. You work with an investment manager, whereas CalPERS, you just give them the money and they kind of do whatever. So just to kind of keep that control over it, and you kind of know what investments you're putting your money into.
Now, we also have the option that should, we've looked at a number of the economic forecasts and the leading indicators, and we've had the the folks here that help us with that. They say that recession is at least 18 months out. Mm-hmm. But let's say it's only 19 months out, okay? And we start to see that recession. We can then, and so our income starts to suffer. Our sales tax and other things start to suffer. We can then draw on the PARs to make our PERS payment. Is
right.
that true?
As long as it's for the pension, because it's only for pension.
Okay. And that's one of the other benefits, mm-hmm. is we can use it to fill in gaps in the future.
And that's what our strategy was, is that we can kind of keep our budget kind of stabilized, maybe going up slightly, but not having these big, these steep hikes and spikes into the budget process. So
The reality is PERS might be a better bet than PARS in a given point in time, right? But we're not putting all our eggs in one basket by doing the
right.
PARS thing.
And we don't have to do it to PARS every single time we get a bunch of money and put it there. We could make a payment straight to. It depends on the circumstances of what's going on with the pension at CalPERS.
But that's a flexibility we retain by putting it into PARS.
Mm-hmm. And it's...
Remember, right? One of your flexibility points is not just that we can use that trust to pay and offset the spiking of the PERS payments, but we also pay general fund dollars to PERS as a course of business. And if the need should ever arise, if we use the PARS payment to pay the regular general fund contributions, then that general fund contribution is kind of a backdoor way of accessing the money, but it also creates that greater flexibility.
And we have a pretty good idea of what our PERS payment is going to be for next year and the year beyond, right?
Right, we do.
And it's going up how much next year?
It's going up.
I think it's about 4%.
Yeah. I think, and I want to say dollar-wise, I know when we did the analysis, we showed that just going into the new year is probably an increase of $500,000, but then it jumps to over $1 million. In the second year.
4 or 5 years, it goes up by $4 million.
Yeah, it's supposed
that's why I thought it was going. All right.
So what we still need to do is every year during the budget process, we want to do an analysis and come back to the council every year as part of the budget process to kind of look at everything, how the balances in each of the trusts are doing. So before we make it, just automatically say we're going to send $1 million or whatever, we want to do an analysis every year just to kind of see that we have the funding to
mm-hmm.
put more in the trust and how CalPERS is looking, so it all plays a part in our analysis.
Okay.
When did we put the 100 grand in? In November?
Yeah, I think once we got all the paperwork and everything, we didn't send the $100,000 right away because we had to set the funds up. So I want to say
in March.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you need from us what?
Recommendation
to whatever
we
in the staff report. Could you emphasize the flexibility issues associated with putting money into PERS versus PARS, and how that allows for us to make choices in the future that wouldn't necessarily be available to us? If we put the money today into PERS, it lowers our liability, but it doesn't help a lot in our future increase payments. Though those future increases are coming at us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so by putting the money into PARS, we could use this money in the future to mitigate some of that, or during a financial downturn, we can use this to make up some of our PERS payments and relieve some pressure on the general fund. And if you could add into some statements about those elements of flexibility, I think that would help.
What is the next level of risk above moderately conservative?
It's moderate, I think it's
called. I think it's moderate.
It's a little bit more aggressive, but that pretty decent returns.
I'd prefer to be moderate myself than moderately conservative.
I was inclined to go that way myself. I think they have like 7, and this was not the most conservative, which is almost all bonds, and not the second. I think this was the third most conservative. And they said that most of their clients are in
the moderate.
This one,
yes.
And the one that's slightly more aggressive.
I'm a very aggressive investor, mm-hmm. because my view is that there's a long time horizon, so I need to be aggressive, and I've lived with
right.
kicks in the gut and said, okay, well, this is what it's like. Moderate to me seems like a reasonable place to be considering what we're trying to accomplish with this.
Right.
Yeah.
You put together a comparison of this, the returns based upon the current moderate conservative and the next most aggressive, and show in a more summarized table the entire spectrum of what they offer.
Okay.
That'd be helpful.
From the most conservative
to the
most
aggressive. Is that timing okay?
Yeah, because we didn't. I have it going to council if this was moved forward to the June 26th.
Okay.
So we have time to include that.
And just a reminder, I will miss the first meeting in July, but I'll be here for the second meeting in July.
Okay.
I get back on the 17th of July.
Okay. So we'll add those two things, comparisons of the moderately conservative.
Right.
And the next option,
right.
and then also the flexibility.
Yeah, a statement as to why this is why we got into this in the beginning,
right.
Just to remind people, was the whole flexibility issue,
and that members of the finance committee's recommendation was to look at the moderate level. Okay, I think that's it, right?
Yep.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks again for